Marilyn Webb has been a writer, educator, and professor, but never got to finish her doctorate. Back in the 60s, her male professor sexually harassed her, and she eventually left the program. 52 years later, this weekend, she's getting her PhD from the University of Chicago. Plus, last week marked the 75th anniversary of D-Day. We take a flight in one of the last B-17 bombers still in the air and speak to Illinois veterans about their memories of World War II.
The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media, airing on WILL in Urbana, WUIS in Springfield, WGLT in Normal, WNIJ in DeKalb, and WCBU in Peoria.
That's all coming up this hour on the 21st. Stay tuned. Welcome to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Coming up later this hour, we'll be taking you on a flight in a B-17 bomber. This type of aircraft was critical during World War II, and a restored flying fortress, as they are known, has been making some flights here in Illinois. We'll speak with the pilots who flew the plane to commemorate the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, and we'll speak with two veterans who share about their memories of World War II. But first, it's graduation season, a time when we celebrate the often incredibly stressful years of effort that go into getting a degree like a PhD. Imagine, though, having to wait more than 50 years for your hard work to be recognized. Marilyn Webb started her graduate degree in educational psychology at the University of Chicago in the 1960s. But when she was nearing the end of her program in 1967, she was sexually harassed by two male professors she asked to be on her dissertation committee. With no systems in place during that time to address her problems, she left with her dream of a doctorate derailed. Marilyn moved to Washington, D.C. and became active in the feminist movement and has had a successful career not just as a writer and editor, but also a professor. She co-chaired the journalism department at Knox College in Galesburg, Illinois, where she's still a professor emerita of journalism. And 52 years later, this weekend, the University of Chicago is working to correct the injustice that drove Marilyn out of her doctoral program as a young woman. This Saturday, she graduates with her PhD. We had a chance to speak with her before she came back to Illinois earlier while she was still at her home in New York. Marilyn, welcome to the 21st. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Hi, Noah. Thank you.
I wonder if you can share what first took you to University of Chicago in the 1960s.
Well, I was an undergraduate at Brandeis University, and I was studying there with lots of incredibly talented professors, including Abraham Maslow, who was a psychology professor and now renowned. And I became very interested in educational psychology. So I applied to two graduate programs that I really thought were superb. One was at Chicago and the other was Harvard. And I got accepted at both and decided that Chicago was my preferred program. So I went there. And that was in the fall of 1964.
And so fast forward 3 years, as you're nearing the end of your program, you'd already completed all of your coursework and the preliminary exams for your PhD. And then can you tell us what happened?
I had been very involved in starting a preschool program that was a parent-run preschool. It was post Mississippi Freedom Summer, so we used a lot of the ideas from Mississippi Freedom Summer to do this program. And then I was also asked to be, I was the director of that program. Then I was asked to be the director of another program, which was run by Saul Alinsky and the Woodlawn Organization, TWO, and they had a preschool. So I was director of both preschools, one parent-run and one not. They were both similarly, the population was mainly, you know, African-American mothers, and so it was the same. So I wanted to do, I had gotten a grant from the Office of Economic Opportunity as a pilot project for Head Start, and I wanted to do my dissertation on comparing these two programs because they were really different programs. So I went to see the head of the program that I was, who was my mentor, and wanted to present my work to him to say, this is how I want to do my dissertation, will you be on my committee? And he said, yes, he would be on my committee, but he wanted to come over to my apartment and give me baths. So I said I didn't think so, and so he said he didn't think so. So that was that.
So you said no, and he said that I'm not going to be on your committee?
Basically, yeah. He said he just, yes. So then I wanted to find somebody else, and I needed three people. So I had another person whose field also had to do with children, and I went to see him, and I didn't get more than three words out of my mouth when I was sitting on one side of his desk and he was on the other, and he raced around his desk and pinned me to the wall and told me it was quid pro quo and started kissing my face. All my papers flew all over the place, and I don't even know how I got out of the office. I just remember thinking, should I pick up my papers or should I just run? And I can't even remember which I did, but I ended up leaving the office, and I had no dissertation committee. So I thought of a third person, but it was people said that's going to be the same thing, my close girlfriends. So there were at that time, as far as I knew, two women at the University of Chicago on the faculty. They were all men, and the two women were both famous in different fields. But I was doing work with children, so there was nobody I could go to, and more importantly, there were no women on the faculty. So I didn't have much recourse. And at that time, there wasn't even a word for sexual harassment. There wasn't a word. There wasn't any kind of structure, like there no Title IX office and no grievance committees. There was no place to go. So I knew I had no way of coping with this institutionally, so I left. And I don't know that I actually was conscious of what happened next, but I was one of the early people who've been the early founders of the women's movement. And so I started, when I went to Washington after that, I started organizing women. And I it was early consciousness-raising groups, and I was one of the people responsible for the first national conferences that there were on the women's liberation movement. And so we started talking about the conditions that women found themselves in. Amongst them was, you know, what I had gone through, although I have to say I didn't talk about that experience myself as my own experience till many years later. It was a kind of secret because I was just so shocked that it had happened. So that was basically my story.
Well, thank you for sharing that. And, I mean, when we think about that, you're being active in the women's movement. You mentioned Title IX. I believe that was 1972, correct? So I wonder how you feel like your experience in graduate school informed the work that you did within the women's movement.
Well, as I said, I can't say that it was conscious, but it was there from the start. And I feel like this is a story that has a very happy ending in terms of the women's movement, because when I went back this time to ask if I could finish my degree in light of the Me Too movement, this is now 50 years later, I decided to do this on my 75th birthday. I wrote to the president and I said, you know, we have these experiences now with the Me Too movement and Harvey Weinstein and Bill Cosby and whatever. And it would be really great if the university could recognize that these things have happened for years and years and years and make things right. And so I really didn't expect, I don't know what I expected.
You wrote the president of the university, Maryland?
Who did? Yes.
Okay.
I actually didn't expect a response because I actually had tried several years before, in the 70s, because I wanted to finish my degree. And I was totally rebuffed. So I just wanted to tell him, this is what happened to me, and this has been going on for years and years, and now it's 50 years later. What I wanted to do was I had written a book that was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize, and I wanted him to use that book and just give me my PhD. So, you know, I didn't expect much, but I did have a couple of things that were thoughtful to me. One is that he had gone to the same college I had gone to, and I had been paid for the whole time I was at Chicago. I had a stipend and a grant, and they paid all my tuition by the National Science Foundation. And he had been on the board there, so I thought, well, you know, they were robbed. They paid for me, and then I didn't give them anything. So I thought maybe he'd, you know, kind of feel somewhat sympathetic, but he was totally sympathetic. He didn't answer me, although he just sent me an email saying he wanted to meet me at graduation, so that's nice. But he passed the information along to the provost, who passed the information along to the dean of students, the dean of the social sciences in the graduate division. And this is where the interesting thing happened, which is there were no women faculty, except for those two that I knew of, and there were, I didn't know any administrators who were women. But now we have Amanda Woodard is the first woman social science dean, the first person who's a woman in that position. And so she convened a committee to see, you know, whether my story was accurate or what. And that they decided that, yes, that I could come and we could talk about how I would finish my degree. And I have to say I was just floored. I just didn't expect that they would say there would be a yes. But, you know, there was a qualification. So my book was based on reporting on, it was called The Good Death, and it's based on how we die in America. So it was a reported book. But it wasn't an academic book. It was a journalistic book. And they wanted me to write a theoretical formulation for what a good death means. And I had no idea what that meant. So they basically formed a committee of
So you got a dissertation committee in the end.
Yes. Two feminist women and an African-American man. I considered them all my feminist offspring. A generation had gone by, and they completely understood completely what had happened. They, you know, when they had done that, they understood what it was like to be in academia and in the world and had known of experiences like that from their own graduate programs. So they wanted to make things right. And I didn't have to explain anything. They said, we understand. We want to make things right. We want the university to be on the forefront of making a change so that women who not only don't have these experiences anymore, but that there can be some redress. So I have to say that when they told me this and I realized we're talking about a complete shift in culture because of the women's movement, I went outside afterwards and I sat in that quadrangle and with all the ivy-covered walls and the stone and the gothicness and the cathedral playing its, you know, bells, and I just sat there and cried. It was just so heartwarming that things had changed so much.
Imagine it was a very cathartic moment for you.
Well, I just couldn't believe the world had shifted on its axis that much for women in my position. And so I'm very grateful to the university I think it's going to be setting a new trend. I'm grateful that the University of Chicago is going to be on the forefront of this and that these women who set up this committee for me and helped me through this and the African-American scholar, they all are just, I just hold them in such incredible esteem, and I'm very grateful to the president, Robert Zimmer.
Marilyn, I understand that you are going to be traveling to the graduation this weekend at the University of Chicago with your family. I wonder if you can share why it's especially important for you to have your family with you.
Well, it's my family, meaning it's my husband and some of my grandchildren, and then there's several women friends who have been my best friends for, you know, years. So it's going to be 20 people, and some cousins are coming. There, people are coming from all over the country. First of all, they're so supportive of, everybody's been so supportive of my, it took me the last 9 months I've been working on this dissertation, and all these different people helped me in various ways. So they're just like my cheering squad. But I'm particularly thrilled that my grandchildren are there. I want them to see that things can change. If they care about something enough and they work at it, like, you know, change for women, that change can happen in the world. And they shouldn't get frustrated. It may have taken me 50 years, but the world has changed for women. And there are negative things happening that need to be fought back against right now. But this particular thing is a complete positive, and I want them to see that.
That's Marilyn Webb, a professor emeritus of journalism at Knox College, author of The Good Death, which was nominated for a Pulitzer Prize. And as she's been telling us about, she spent the last 9 months reworking to be a dissertation. She'll be receiving her PhD from the University of Chicago this weekend, 5 decades after the sexual harassment by professors caused her to leave the program. Marilyn, congratulations on your doctorate, and thank you so much for joining us and sharing your story. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for doing this, and I'm glad to see women in your position, too.
Thank you. Coming up next on the 21st, we're taking you on board a restored B-17 bomber. It's just one of about a dozen that are still airworthy. And we're going to speak with an Illinois veteran who flew on these aircraft during World War II. That's just after this break. Stay tuned. You're listening to the 21st. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. During World War II, the B-17 bomber became known as the Flying Fortress for its ability to fly solo for hours on end and strike targets deep behind enemy lines. Today, fewer than 15 of these airplanes are still able to take to the skies. And the Experimental Aircraft Association's Aluminum Overcast is one of them. This summer, the EAA is flying the plane across the U.S. to give people a peek into our aviation history. Last Thursday, on the 75th anniversary of the D-Day invasion, the Aluminum Overcast came to Champaign's Willard Airport. I had a chance to ride aboard the B-17 and talk to its pilots. Here's some of what I heard.
Beginning of the war, this was absolute state-of-the-art. This is like looking at a B-2 bomber today. It was so state-of-the-art that crowds would gather when these things came around, because this was bigger, sleeker, and because of that, faster than anything anyone had ever seen. I'm Neil Morrison, a volunteer pilot of the EEA's B-17 Aluminum Overcast. I live in Port Townsend, Washington, and the airplane is based out of Oshkosh, Wisconsin. If you were in World War II, you're 95 years or older, so we don't see as many World War II pilots come out, but when we do and we get to meet one, it makes my month, you know, to meet one guy for a little bit and talk to him a little bit about what he saw, what he did.
And as you walk around the airplane, even now, you know, I'm sure Neil gets the same thing. You know, we've been flying this. Neil's been flying it about twice as long as I have. But even now, after 8 years, you still get that ghostly feeling of these guys being there before you at 17. So, with that said, no fighters today. It's not going to be 35 below. But try and imagine what it's like today.
Great. Look, we're in the radio room.
might tear up while reading this. June 6th, 1944, 7 a.m. This guy's writing it in a diary at 7 a.m. What does that mean to you? You already flew for the day, 7 a.m. Underlined, bold print, invasion day. We got up at 1 a.m. when they said, this is it. We knew what was coming. The day we have all been waiting for. We had 38 100-pound bombs, more planes than I have ever seen before. There were supposed to have been 11,000 take part in the invasion. Our target was covered with clouds, but just before we come to the enemy coast, there was a big hole in the clouds. Down there, I could see hundreds of ships, some shelling the coast, others waiting to land troops. Every little hole in the clouds, you could see fighters or light and medium bombers all headed for the same place. Our bombs fell down like rain. I only hope we helped out the infantry and all the rest who landed there.
That was Neil Morrison and Rex Gray with the Experimental Aircraft Association. Thanks to Jasper Davidoff and Alex Coleman for their help producing that audio postcard. The aluminum overcast is at Peoria's Downing Airport this Friday through Sunday. For more information on ground tours or flights, visit EAA.org or you can find the link at our website, 21stshow.org. There are also veterans living today who served on B-17s during the war, and one of them is Harold Huffman. He was a flight engineer and a top turret gunner. I visited him at his home in Arcola, Illinois this week, and he told me about flying missions over Europe, getting shot down over Sweden, but he started with where he was on D-Day.
I was in the middle of the Atlantic on a troop ship on my way over. The name of the troop ship was the Rangitata. It was an English ship that had hauled meat from Australia to England during both the first part of the war. Then the United States had them hauling troops to England with it. And we were in a convoy that was about 50 miles long, they said. We were on the ocean about 17 days. In the middle of our trip, that's when June 6th came along. Mm. I first flew on my first combat mission on July the 4th, 1944. We went to bomb a bridge and a road, and the Germans couldn't get their tanks across the river because of us blowing up the bridge and ruining the road, and the water got so deep that they couldn't get across with their tanks. Just a few days later, we went to Munich. We were in the air over 10 hours. The airplane would fly about 10 hours and 30 minutes on the gasoline it had. I think we lost three airplanes in the English Channel on the way back that ran out of gasoline. If they were lucky, they were picked up by a patrol boat that was belonged to England rather than the Germans.
So you flew 25 missions?
Right, 25. Actually, I had 28, but three of them I didn't count because we didn't drop the bombs.
And your role was flight engineer?
Flight engineer and top turret gunner. For the top turret bubble, I had the top 180 degrees of the aircraft and 360 degrees of azimuth.
So I sat in your position, and that was when I started feeling really sick, you know, in that turret where you were in the front. And I sat up there, and we were only about 1,100 feet in the air. But I just looked over, and I just started feeling really queasy when I was in the glass. Could you see when you were sitting up there? Because it was all glass. Could you see below, or was it nighttime and cloudy and dark?
No, I could see below most of the time, but the thing is, my time in actual combat I spent looking into the sun, because the German fighters like to come out of the sun, so because you couldn't see them as well and as quick. So I spent most of my time looking into the sun, and you spend 5 or 6 hours just staring right into the sun. It affects your eyes and your skin and that sort of thing. That's why I have this scar up here on my forehead. You can see that.
Mm. So, that's from the war.
That's a cancerous section from the sun.
Mm. How old were you at this point, Harold?
I started at 21 years old, and my birthday was October 15th, 1944. I became 22 that day. We went to Heligoland Island. 28 planes of us went to Heligoland Island. We dropped anti-personnel bombs on the guns and the crews. And when we left, as we were leaving, this was an island off the coast of Denmark between Denmark and Germany. The Germans had it occupied. there were caverns underneath this island. It was 60-some feet high. The Germans refurbished their submarines in there. As we left that area, as we looked, there was a mothership came in, and they had three old drone aircraft with it. That was a secret mission we were on at the time. The secret of it was, that's the first I knew that we had television cameras and television receivers. And that drone aircraft had the receivers in it with three pilots piloting those ships with radio controls. And they flew them into those caverns. Those old B-17s that they flew into there were stripped down and had 20,000 pound of TNT on them. The gasoline that was in the tanks also blew up when they stripped the wings off as they went into these caverns.
Wow. Do you remember how you used to feel before you were going on those missions?
Well, when you have enough training as I had, you're not scared right at the time. During the mission, you become a little excited maybe, but your training takes over and everything works. At the time, after you get on the ground afterwards, that's when you're scared.
And what kind of training did you get to become a flight engineer? How did you become a flight engineer?
I went to airplane mechanic school, became an engine specialist in there, and being an engine specialist automatically kind of made me a flight engineer, and then as I became a good gunner, the pilots requested me. I flew with about six different pilots, not 25 missions. I was a farm boy. We did everything ourselves. We made everything that we needed to on the farm ourselves. The government liked to pick guys like me for flight engineers because we could do a lot of things that other people couldn't do. I was very handy with tools.
So you served for, was it 3 years then? Did it end up being, or no. Two?
2 years, 9 months, and 16 days.
And you remember the exact day?
Certainly. Now, the reason I do is because I have a good memory, and even though I'm 96 years old, I can remember it like it was yesterday.
What do you remember the most? What stands out the most to you, especially as I'm thinking, I'm looking at the picture that you have on the wall here of the B-17, of flying in those?
Takeoff is what I remember the most because I had the most to do then. I called the airspeed and the altimeter reading for the pilot and the co-pilot so that they could watch their instruments and so that they could watch the runway and make sure everything was okay. So in doing that, we were three people working together to doing that, and it was quite a job. I mean, just sit there and stand there and right behind them and call out those numbers for them so that they didn't have to read it on their scale.
How many guys were in the B-17 with you? How big was the crew?
At first there were 10, and then they changed it to 9 because they were running out of men.
Was it cold?
Well, when the day that we got hit over Hamburg, Germany, on January the 17th, 1945, it was 57 degrees below zero where we were, 24,000 feet. Well, I had on a helmet. I had on gauntlets. I had on a heated suit that's like an electric blanket is today, a heated suit, but it didn't cover your feet. That was one of the problems. And I had to wear that Mae West in case you got in the water, that you could inflate it so that you didn't drown. So that rubbed your neck pretty raw, too. So that and the oxygen mask was not the most comfortable thing in the world.
Do you mind talking about when you got shot down?
No, I'll tell you about
it. What happened?
Well, we lost one of the engines. We lost number 2 engine, and we lost number 3 engine. And right after that, we lost some altitude, a little bit of altitude, maybe a couple hundred feet. And a shell went through our wing right behind the number 3 engine in the main gas tank, made a hole about 5 inches. And the gasoline came out and caught on fire behind us, back at the tail, that stream of gasoline. And the pilot, I called him immediately and told him what had happened. And he dived the aircraft, which changed the attitude of the gasoline in the tank, and the tank went dry pretty fast. By the time he got the fumes out, we were from 24,000, we were down to about 1,200 feet, less than a quarter of a mile.
And then he was able to land the plane?
Well, we landed in Sweden. We went across Denmark. We didn't have gasoline enough back to get back to England, out the North Sea. So we went to Sweden, across Denmark, and we had about 7 or 8 minutes gasoline left when we landed, and we landed on a grass field with two engines. It wasn't an airfield like you would think. It was used for small planes, not big planes. They didn't have any runways. We didn't know which way the wind was blowing. We just had to land. That's all there was to it.
What was going through your head when you realized that you were going to have to land in Sweden?
Well, we weren't sure we were in Sweden, so when we got out of the plane, the pilot said we were all armed with 45 revolvers. And he said, don't give up your guns, but keep your hands off of them until I tell you to. So the Swedish Army came towards us, and they were all riding bicycles, carrying our version of the Tommy gun. And they had it strapped on their back, and they rode these bicycles up and got off. About that time, one of the guys from the crowd that had gathered, because we had taxied up to the main area, and one of the guys from the crowd said, you're in Sweden, you're in a neutral country, they're not Germans. So he said, okay, and he had told us we'd give up the guns.
Sweden was neutral territory at the time?
It was neutral. Now, I didn't make the rules, but any time that you're in a foreign country against your will for 31 days or more during wartime, you're automatically a prisoner of war. So I was listed as a prisoner of war.
But you were in neutral territory, so it wasn't like you were...
I was in a big rest home called Humlebaken up by Falun, Sweden, but I was not in a concentration camp, no.
I think it's probably hard for those of us who didn't live through World War II to imagine what it was like here in the U.S. When you were drafted, how did you feel about going to serve?
I could hardly wait. I wanted to go serve. As an example, now we will be passing a July the 4th before very long. Last year, July, is Saudi Arabia. Last July, they allowed their women to start driving their cars. Think of that right here, right now. Women's always driven a car.
So for you, you felt like you were fighting for freedom. Is that an accurate way to describe it?
It's very accurate, because those freedoms are very, very real, and we can't let them get away either. We have to. I don't tell people how to vote. I tell them how not to vote. Don't vote for anybody that wants to get rid of the Second Amendment, wants to get rid of anything in the amendments. That's why the Constitution was written. That's why everybody wants to come here at this country rather than leave. Nobody wants to leave. They want to come here.
And when you think about that time now, does it seem like it's been 75 years?
Well, not to me, because I've talked at schools. When I found out that schools were not teaching anything about World War II, that's when I started talking about it. I've talked to people, many, many, many schools and many places, just to keep people refreshed on it.
What do you want young people to know about World War II and what you did? How do you want them to think about it?
I'd rather they thought about what caused it and the things that to do to prevent it more than anything else. You can't have dictators, you can't have socialism, you can't have communism. You have to have just plain old capitalism, and people go to school as they should.
You wanted to show me some of these other ones.
Yeah, I want to show you some of the other pictures. I was taken on January the 8th, about January the 18th or 19th, 20th, but it was taken in January of 1945. Can you pick me out of that bunch there?
I'm looking. I picked you out only because of the name. Is that you right there?
Me right there. I was 22 years old.
And is this in Sweden?
That's in Sweden, and we all had Swedish sweaters. And we were not allowed to wear anything with a uniform of any kind. We had to wear civilian clothes.
And they gave you Swedish sweaters to wear?
They didn't give them to us. We had to buy them. They don't give anything away.
That was World War II veteran Harold Huffman speaking to me from his Central Illinois home. After the break, we'll hear more about his experience serving in Europe. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Stay tuned. You're listening to The 21st. Thanks for listening to The 21st. I'm Nyla Boodoo. You've been hearing my interview with Harold Huffman. He served as a flight engineering gunner during World War II aboard a B-17 bomber in Europe. I spoke with him at his home in Arcola in central Illinois. Here's the rest of our conversation.
I'd like to tell you about our last mission I was on. We went past Hamburg, Germany, and came back from the east, came back towards the North Sea, which was west of Hamburg, and came over a little town of Liebeck, Germany. And we got hit just right after Liebeck, Germany, and that's when we lost our two engines and lost our way. After we got pulled out of this dive that I mentioned that we were in that cleaned out the gas tank, the pilot had me, he said, now get rid of all the weight. That's when I had to get rid of the ball turret, had to get rid of the radio. We all had on what was called a flak jacket, weighed about anywhere from 12 to 15 pounds. And it was made out of, some of them were aluminum, some of them were steel plates in there, in this jacket, so that if a piece of anti-aircraft fire hits your jacket, if you were lucky, it didn't go through it. At any rate, I got rid of those. Nine guys times 12, that's another 100 pounds you got rid of, see. Everything that would move that we didn't need, I got rid of by throwing it out.
Where'd you throw it out of?
Some of it went out to bomb bay, but now like the ball turret, it's behind the bomb bay to the rear of the plane. And as I dropped that ball turret, then the side guns out at the way, from the waist gun and the ammunition dropped it right out of there. Mm. After I threw everything out and we landed, and then we were quartered in a place called Humlebach, and we learned to ski there, and we had quite a time there.
Well, Harold, thank you for sharing these stories with us, and thank you for sharing your memories. I really appreciate it.
Thank you for being here.
Thanks again to Harold for hosting us. Of course, World War II was being fought all over the world. While Harold was in Europe, John Nofel was serving with the Navy's Amphibious Corps in the Pacific Theater. He was at both Iwo Jima and Okinawa. When he came back to the U.S., he later worked as a professor of English at the University of Illinois Springfield. John and his wife Peggy joined me from Springfield at our partner station, NPR Illinois.
We're getting to be fewer and fewer now.
Yes, know? Unfortunately, there are fewer and fewer of you guys. Do you have... John, is there a, where you live now, there are quite a few veterans who live where you are?
There are a number, yeah. Old men.
And how often do you guys trade these war stories? Do you talk about it a lot?
No. Actually we don't.
Do you think it's important to share these stories?
Well, especially as we're getting fewer, I think it's good to let people know what you experienced. I talked a lot with Peg about what we'd done.
So now you were 21 when you were drafted, is that right?
No, I was not drafted. See, as soon as the Japanese bombed Pearl Harbor, people just volunteered right away. And I was in the field artillery in ROTC. And
you volunteered?
Yes, I didn't like the field artillery, so I went down and volunteered and enlisted in the Navy.
And you ended up being in the Naval Amphibious?
Yeah, Naval Amphibious Corps.
What did you do?
Well, we worked in small boats, landing craft vehicle personnel and landing craft tanks. And our job was to take the troops in on those boats and the equipment.
And you were in the Pacific Theater.
I was in the Pacific.
So you were with, when you said you were with, and your job was to take people in, these were Marines and Army? Where did you take folks into?
We took the 5th Marines into Iwo Jima and the 27th Army into Okinawa.
So, John, you wrote a poetry about World War II.
I did. What was that called, Peg?
It was when you were going at the site of that enormous battle, and you wrote about how beautiful it was, and then how when you went through, nobody in the whole fleet said a word. It was total silence.
When we went down through the Straits of Solomon, there was total silence on the ship, because that's where so many had gone down. And the Japanese came in two columns, and the American flotilla steamed up between them. And the Japanese, when they fired, if they overfired, they would hit their own side. And our Navy was, they'd fire on one side and then set them up in the other alley and fire the other. But it was terrible. There was all the officers aboard that, our ships were dead. Mm. They had to bring somebody up from below to run the ships.
Well, that poem you wrote about crossing through the, on the side of that battle.
Do you remember the name of that poem?
I don't remember the name of it, but John, do you remember the last lines of it? I do.
What are they?
We knew the dead were our own dead, and we gave them silence
under
Savo.
Say that again, Peg. Can you say it for us, please?
We knew the dead were our own dead, and we gave them silence under Savo.
Yeah, when we came down there was total silence on the ship because that had been a tremendous battle with terrible losses, but it was a very significant victory, too.
But it's interesting to me that you really you remember that silence, so much so that you wrote about it years later.
Yes, I did, and it was a strange, impressive moment.
John, did you write while you were fighting? Did you write then?
I think I tried, but it was terrible.
John, when you were going on those missions, do you remember how you felt? Were you scared?
Well, you were always scared, but you also were pumped up, too. You were excited. I remember when we were going into Iwo, the Japanese, they fired a shot and it went over my head and dumped into my fantail. Well, I didn't see it, you know. But Ensign behind me, he almost had a heart attack.
Wow. And then was it Okinawa where you were injured?
No, I was injured at Iwo. That's a very curious thing. It seemed to heal.
But what happened? You know, how did you get the injury? Sure. Remember, it was the night after they put the flag up, there was word of kamikazes.
Yeah.
What was the fleet doing?
Well, the fleet opened up. We weren't firing because we didn't see anything up there. But we were watching it, and I said, well, some of this is going to come down. And some did, and they caught me behind my knee.
So you got hit in the back of your knee?
Yeah, probably by friendly fire.
Mm-hmm. And then what happened? I mean, obviously, you were hit at that point. Did you immediately...
I passed out, and everybody disappeared. I think they thought I was dead. And when I came to, I was by myself, and I started to yell for a corpsman. That was heard, and they brought me down to, we had a place for this with a doctor, and they managed to staunch the blood. I thought I was all right, but later I felt back of my knee, and there was big bulge there, and it was pulsing. And what had happened was the artery had knitted to the vein and the vein to the artery. It was an arterial
aneurysm.
Oh, my. And what did they do?
Well, they told me that I might die any day with that.
Well, they were wrong because you lived quite a long time.
Yeah, but I said, you better take me off ship's duty.
So where did they send you to get help? Because you're out in the Pacific at this point, right?
Yes. Well, now this is a long story here. There was an island where there was a doctor who could perform that operation. It's a very delicate operation. And they sent me to that island.
And was there anyone there who could help you at that island?
No. The doctor who could do that had left.
Oh, no. So then where did they send you?
Well, on this island, the Japanese managed to mount an air attack there. It was late in the war. It was amazing. But they didn't. It didn't hit anything.
So then they sent you then to Hawaii?
Well, we went to Hawaii then. Nobody there could do it. Went to San Francisco. Nobody there could do it. So then we went to Great Lakes, and there was a doctor there who was able to do this. And he managed to get those veins and arteries back where they belonged. But it was a long time healing from that.
A long time healing. John, you received a Purple Heart during the war.
I did. That was from that shell burst that got me.
John, how did you feel when you received the Purple Heart?
Well, I was glad to get it. And I cherish it, you know, because it marks something you were able to do and survive.
And you do. So, John, you do really remember a lot of this.
Well, as I say, most of the people that fought in World War II are gone now. There are not many of us left.
You had a memory of Okinawa that didn't go away.
Oh, yeah. What I did see that morning was a young woman. She'd been shot, I guess, and she was on the trail. Her legs were already swollen a bit, and she had a bean pot, a little clay pot, and it spilled out in front of her. And I understand that in Okinawa they had these massive family grave sites up on the hills, so she would never be there. They would never know who she was. What happened to her. And I asked what the armies would do, and they said, well, they would put her under with a bulldozer. Mm. I've never forgotten this. It always reminds me of the kind of ravages and insanity of war.
But I wonder what you want people today to remember about World War II.
Well, it was important because it righted terrible wrongs. That was important. And we were on the right side of that war. And that's important. I'm not sure you can say that for some of the other combats we've been in.
But you can say that for what you fought. You fought for the war that you fought in.
Yeah. But as I say, most of the people that fought in World War II are gone now. There are not many of us left.
Well, we appreciate that you are here to share your story with us. Peggy, John, thank you for being with me and sharing these stories. I very much appreciate it.
I'm glad he got to tell his story.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have for today. You can follow us on Twitter. Our handle is 21STShow. We live tweet during the program with more analysis and background about what we're talking about. When we're not on air, you can follow us for the latest in Illinois news. We're on Facebook, too, if you want to search for the 21st to like us. That's another way to comment on what we're working on or post questions or comments that you would like us to ask on air. All of those links, every other way to contact us. We love hearing from you. If you want to leave us a voicemail, send us an email, or find our social media handles, all you have to remember is our website, which is 21stshow.org. And you can find our past shows most places you get your podcasts. We're on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, NPR One. Search for The 21ST. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Nyla Boodoo. Thanks for listening.